Me personally, it was a very slow progression, and they're very secretive illnesses. That's the thing that I think a lot of people don't realize. Like, so much that goes on is behind closed doors and hidden. So a lot of my habits and behaviors were very much kept to myself. I sort of hid a lot of things from my parents and lied, a lot of lying. You are in denial yourself about what's going on, and you lie to kind of keep everyone else happy.
Life gives you two choices when it throws everything at you. You can let it swallow you whole, or you take those lemons. And as the old saying goes, you turn it into sweet, delicious lemonade. And that's exactly what this podcast is all about. Welcome to Lemonade. I'm your host, Elizabeth O'Neill, and I'll be sharing the incredible stories from inspiring people who've turned the hardest times in their life, their lemons, into lemonade. Because we all want to know how they did it, the lessons they learnt, and what life is like sipping limoncello on the other side. Let's get juicing. Maddie Tyers is an actress, TV host, and you may even recognise her from her stint on Channel 9's Lego Masters. But what you may not know is the effervescent Maddie has been on quite the journey in her lifetime. At the age of 8, she developed an eating disorder. By the age of 16, she was hospitalised, doctors fearing for her life because she was so unwell. Maddie is now 32 and it's taken many, many years in recovery to get to the point she's at today. And she's thriving. Maddie has just released a children's book, When Anna Came to Town, aimed at that vulnerable 5 to 12-year-old age group to encourage body positivity and help young children identify disordered eating habits. Now, just a note, there were a few technical glitches thanks to the joys of recording online through lockdown. I hope they don't distract too much from Maddie's beautifully contagious energy. Trigger warning, this episode discusses eating disorders. 24-hour help is available through the Butterfly Foundation on 1800 334 673 or Lifeline on 13 11 14. Here's Maddie. Maddie, welcome to the Lemonade Podcast. You are so glam for a 9:30 on a Saturday morning. What is your secret?
Thank you so much. I tell you what, this is the first time I've put makeup on in, I reckon, 2 months. Oh. I thought, it's a Saturday morning. I'm yep. chatting with the lovely Liz. Why the hell not? Let's glam up.
Let's glam it up. I was saying off mic to you, like, I feel like I've just stumbled. I look like I've just stumbled out of bed. I haven't just stumbled out of bed.
And you look gorgeous.
You are just a princess. Gorgeous. So yes, it'd be lovely to chat to you for the next hour. Maddie, how are you doing? How is everything? There was an earthquake this week. Melbourne's going crazy. No. How are you faring?
Oh, Liz, honestly, it is just bonkers at the moment. Yes. Like you said, it's almost like what's the world going to throw at us today, you know? Riots, a lockdown for 2 years, an earthquake. Yep. We're fully prepared. My husband is a massive zombie movie apocalypse kind of fan, diehard fan. And so he's prepared for anything, you know, zombies, aliens, whatever it is that kind of, throws its...
Is there a bunker? Is there something set up just in case everything just falls to shit?
You know what? I'm going to say no, and I think that's our next lockdown project. You've just given us something to do.
Well, you've got a few more months of it.
No, look, we're doing okay though, Liz. Like, you know, all that in consideration, you know, we're keeping busy. My husband and I are very fortunate to, we live in sort of the inner city Melbourne, and we're very comfortable at home. We're both working from home, so I can't complain.
Now, Maddie, with all my interviews, I start them the same way, and that's just wanting to get a feel of what childhood was like for my guests. So can you tell me what was it like growing up for you?
Yeah. Oh, look, I was, again, very fortunate, Liz. I had a really awesome childhood. I have two wonderful parents who I'm super close with, and are very fortunate in my 5K bubble. So, yay, I've been
lovely
to kind of catch up with them for walks. I have a little sister, Imogen. It's just the two of us, and she's just the best. I love her to bits. She's currently living in Vancouver, so she's been overseas in Canada for a couple of years, but we have always been incredibly close since we were kids. I had a really lovely childhood, you know. We were always very fortunate to you know, you go on little beach holidays, you know, every Christmas time, and, you know, lots of family and friend get-togethers, all that kind of stuff. But look, in saying that too, I was also an incredibly sensitive kid, a really, perfectionistic kind of kid as well. I loved school, but I put a lot of pressure on myself to do well at school. And so, you know, despite having a really, an amazingly incredible supportive network around me, I did have a lot of anxieties and suffered quite a bit from depression as a kid as well, which is crazy to think when you have all this wonderful stuff going for you, how is it that, you know, you're not coping? And then at the age of 8 was when I first sort of started to develop, you know, toxic kind of behaviours and thoughts around food and my body. So, you know, despite the fact that I did have a wonderful childhood and upbringing, I did have some struggles as well.
Yeah.
So, as we all do.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned just then at the age of 8, your attitude towards food started to shift a little. Can you talk us through what was happening there?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think back now and I'm like, gosh, 8, that is so young. Like I think of an 8-year-old now and I'm just like, they're babies. But, you know, at the time, obviously I thought I was super grown up and had everything together. But look, I was, like I said, very perfectionistic, very, very kind of sensitive, incredibly kind of impressionable as well. At the time I had, I had to shift schools. We had, you know, just a bit of a family kind of shift dynamic with my sister and I, and, you know, being that kind of age and uprooting from your kind of friends and having to restart again, I think I just felt completely out of control. And for a kid that was, I suppose, quite in control, I was very confident, you know, always the leader of the group, and for this one time I was kind of, you know, not in control. And I think I sort of found food and you know, controlling what went in and out of my body was what made me feel safe and calm at the time. And it then sort of slowly progressed into becoming a bit of a coping mechanism for any kind of stress and anxiety. And then as you grow up, you know, you sort of head into your preteens and your teens, you know, the hormones and the stresses in life kind of do amplify. And so did my sort of obsession and issues with food. Unfortunately. But yeah, it's crazy to think I'm 32 now. I've been in recovery, you know, and in a good, really good healthy place for like the last 7-8 years. But you know, I have struggled with this for most of my life, which is crazy to think. Look, doing really well now and trying to use my experiences to sort of educate and help others.
Yeah,
that's the goal.
Absolutely. And when you were in these, like, taking you back to these 8, 9, 10 age group, you know, as you said, you're so young, what kinds of things were you doing, and did you have any awareness of what was going on, or that, you know, maybe that there was an issue? Or I suppose you were just so little, it would be hard to know.
Absolutely. You know, it's really interesting kind of thinking back, Liz, because, you know, this is going back to the 90s now. So, you know, I didn't have a mobile phone or social media or, you know, access to, I suppose, the crazy bombarding images and kind of pressures that kids today have. So it was nothing like that, but I still very much felt those pressures of the media and those societal ideas of what woman should look like. So, you know, I think originally it just started out as, you know, Maddie's trying to eat healthy, and it was kind of not really, it was sort of acknowledged by family and friends, but in a really positive way. So, you know, Maddie really loves to exercise, she loves to eat healthy, and she doesn't like junk food. And it really started out as sort of, I suppose, labeling foods as good and bad. And then obviously as time kind of progressed, the list of sort of bad foods just continued to grow and the list of good foods sort of shrunk. So it really was a very slow progression. Like I said, it sort of started, those initial kind of feelings started at around the age of 8, but I wasn't admitted into hospital until I was sort of 15, 16, and in sort of year 9 and 10 at school. And that was when I was officially diagnosed with anorexia. So that's like an 8-year progression of
totally
habits. To my parents' credit, they tried everything they could. They didn't know what was wrong. I suppose eating disorders weren't as, spoken about even at, as they are today. And they are quite a taboo subject as well, like a mental health as it is quite a taboo topic. I'm so happy it's been more spoken about now, but back then, it was really kind of, it was really challenging for my family and friends to go, what's going on with Maddie? She's not doing too well.
As you just said, like that's such a good point. There just wasn't the resources back then as well. There wasn't a click of a button on the internet and a few symptoms and then something comes up. It must have been, did it take a while for your parents to kind of realize what was going on because of that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Like you said, the resources weren't readily available. There were, amazing kind of support networks like the Butterfly Foundation were very much in operation, but they just weren't known about as much. It took my parents a lot of digging and researching and asking, health professionals to find those resources at the time. But look, initially, they were really stumped. They didn't realize what this thing was that was going on in my mind. And I very much, now can separate myself from the illness. But back then it was very much a part of me. And I was completely in denial with what was going on. I just kind of brushed it off as just the way I do things. So, what's wrong with that? Leave me alone kind of
attitude. Yeah. And like you said, just being, you had in your head, I'm being healthy though. There's nothing wrong with what I'm doing. I'm just eating healthy.
Exactly. Exactly. And isn't that what everyone's telling us to do? So what's wrong with that? Really interestingly, I think for my parents, obviously home life was getting quite stressful. Dinner meals, any meal time was a really stressful time. So my parents were kind of quite on edge throughout that period. And so when they started to get comments from, other people, maybe it was family friends or like teachers and stuff about my weight and the way I behaved, it got really upsetting for my parents because they were kind of like, people are making comments, people are saying things, what are we doing wrong as parents? They took a lot of blame onto themselves, which I feel absolutely, shit house about. My sister as well, being 3 years younger than me at the time, she would have been, five or six when it started, and then probably early preteens when I was sort of at the worst of it. But she had to kind of grow up very quickly and she became a huge support for me. And that was, reflecting back now, and we've kind of done quite a lot of therapy and kind of working through that stuff as adults now. And it really affected her growing up. It really had a huge effect because a lot of the attention and kind of stress was focused on me and my health growing up. So,
as you said, it was so... it started with kind of good and bad foods and then more food started getting added to that bad category. And then from there, is it just, is it just the effect of like reducing then the amounts, is that what then would happen over time? Was that kind of the progression until you did become very unwell and have to go to hospital? I'm just curious about what that progression looks like.
Yeah. So interesting. And look, eating disorders of all like come in all shapes and sizes and affect everyone differently, but me personally, it was a very slow progression, and they're very secretive illnesses. That's the thing that I think a lot of people don't realize, like so much that goes on is behind closed doors and hidden. So a lot of my habits and behaviors were very much kept to myself. I sort of hid a lot of things from my parents and lied, a lot of lying. You are in denial yourself about what's going on. And you lie to kind of keep everyone else happy. I think another really kind of key trait, and this is very much generalizing of people with eating disorders, they generally tend to be, very, like I said, perfectionistic, but also people pleasers as well. They want to keep everyone else happy, so they'll say what they need to say to kind of keep them at ease, but the inner turmoil is also incredibly horrible. But it was a very much a slow progression. For me, it was, as I said, a lot of just like hiding stuff. Obviously the meals became less and less, lying that I'd eaten prior to catching up with friends and going out for dinners and having very strict rules around, I went from being pescatarian to vegetarian to like almost vegan, unfortunately we still live in a society that kind of promotes a lot of that sort of thinking and behaviors, and it can be done healthily, in a healthy way, but it also, I think, for those that have a tendency towards I suppose negative self-esteem or body sort of issues, those sort of diets or ways of living can be quite a slippery slope into eating disorders. So and then obviously getting admitted into hospital was at a point where I was kind of I had to choose between having a nasal gastric tube or actually slowly reintroducing feeding. It's learning to sort of eat again. You almost kind of resort back to becoming a child where you're sort of monitored and kind of fed by your parents. And I'm, 16, 17-year-old girl who's been, in all other instances, should be going out and having fun with my friends and doing all that kind of cool stuff. I was at home being kind of like monitored by my parents and watched over while I ate every meal. So it was, pretty, pretty full-on time.
Can you talk to us about, because when you then were admitted into hospital, I can't even imagine how difficult that must have been. What did the doctors tell you at that time?
So it was a matter of, at the time I was going to what they call like an outpatient clinic weekly. So this is prior to being admitted. So obviously I was incredibly underweight and not, my blood pressure was always very low. I was sleeping a lot. My hair was falling out. I had, hair growing on all over my body to try and keep myself warm. Yeah. So I had all these signs of being unwell, but I was going to this clinic weekly to just check heart rate, blood pressure, weight. I got weighed every week that was hidden by the dietitian, so I didn't see what numbers were there.
Because that's very triggering to be weighed weekly. Oh, my God. Yeah.
Absolutely. And, it was terrifying. I used to get petrified of going every week to these appointments and petrified of either putting on weight.
Yeah.
Because that was my worst fear. Or losing weight was also petrifying because I would knew that what that meant. It meant I could possibly go to hospital. And so sooner or later I did have that inevitable day that I got there, and the doctor who was looking after me at the time was like, no, you've officially reached to this, your BMI and your heart rate is way too low. You need to go to hospital now. So it was just, that was a really quite a traumatizing realization, and being kind of dragged, literally kicking and screaming, by my mum to the car to drive me, to drive me to this actual clinic. It was, really
frightening.
Really full on. Frightening. Really, really frightening.
Absolutely. For being
and
so
all
young.
The while. Yeah. And I think the craziest thing too, Liz, is in your mind, in my mind, I thought I was fine. I was like, there's nothing wrong with me. Leave me alone. But, in hindsight, looking back now, I was incredibly unwell.
And they said to you, the doctor said to you, if you continued on the trajectory you're on, you would have a heart attack. Is that right? Is that how well you got?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Gosh. So, when you're malnourished and, in depletion, long periods of time, it affects all your vital organs. So I was diagnosed with osteopenia, which is a stage before osteoporosis at 16, 17. And so my bones were in a really bad place. The threat of potential heart failure and liver, all of your organs are really under stress a lot of the time. So, and your brain as well. Like at the end of the day, you are quite, there's kind of quite a chicken or an egg kind of thing. Like, does the depression start before the eating disorder? Does the eating disorder cause the depression? You're so malnourished in the brain as well. You're not thinking straight.
No.
You're not making sense of normal things. You're not thinking logically. So Yeah, it was a really scary time for my parents. But I also think, in a way, obviously being in hospital was the best thing that happened to me because, you know, it was the start of where, you know, the start of recovery. That my parents finally felt that they, you know, that I was in the right place. The control was taken away from them, that they didn't yes. have to monitor me, and it was, I was being looked after by the people that could make me better, basically. So
yeah absolutely. And how difficult was it to make that first step in your recovery at that mm-hmm. at that point of time?
Yeah, look, it's interesting because I kind of wonder, like, you know, I even think I was still, I think got being admitted into hospital was a bit of a wake-up call, but I don't think it was until really my early 20s that I kind of had another scare. I went overseas, traveled Europe on my own for a couple of months, and used that opportunity to basically resort back to all my old ways. I didn't have anyone looking over me. I was on my own. I could do whatever I wanted, and I came back incredibly unwell and underweight. And you know, this is sort of 21, too. And so I think at that age, and when I returned home, I was like, I can't go back to where I was 6 or 7 years ago. And that's officially when I kind of, in myself, had decided, no, I need to get back on track and sort of, started those appointments with dietitians and psychologists and whatnot, and get a bit of a team around me again. So, yeah, look, I think, you know, like I said, eating disorders are never linear. Your recovery journey is never linear. Even though I was officially diagnosed at that young teenage age, it wasn't until, you know, 5, 6 years later that I kind of, in my own mind, had decided I wanted to get better.
Yeah, and we're ready. Yes, absolutely. And what has that recovery then looked like since then, since your early 20s, when you did make that choice that you're ready to be, to feel better?
Absolutely. And I still very much think I'm in it too. At least, like, I don't think that I, and look, again, I think it's different for every single person that suffers with this illness. But I think for me, it's going to be something I'm going to need to monitor for the rest of my life. You know, I know what I am like when I get stressed and anxious. I'm incredibly fortunate. I have my husband and family and friends around me that I'm very obviously vocal about it now, but also know my triggers and warning signs. So it's just something I'm going to need to monitor. But yeah, recovery has been, it's been a bumpy journey. It's been really, really hard. I like to sort of think of eating disorders a little bit like an addiction of any kind, really, be it alcohol, drugs, gambling, whatever.
Yeah.
You almost get high from the feeling of not eating and being empty. And so having to break that habit and break that toxic cycle, it's really bloody hard. Unlike, I suppose, alcohol or drugs, food is something we have to eat. We have to do this every day. We have to face it. We can't just completely eliminate it, because that's the whole problem in the first place. So it's just kind of relearning and retraining my mind and body about what it means to feel satisfied and to feel good in myself, I think.
So, to rewire that thinking, rewire those pathways. How crucial was therapy during that time then, having someone professional be able to speak to about that? I imagine that must have been that integral cog in all of this. Oh,
absolutely. And it is a team around you. You know, I had obviously a dietitian and stuff, but a psychologist absolutely was quite crucial, because, you know, you obviously talk about your thoughts and feelings around food, but it's all the other stuff, you know, what's actually going on in the, you know, in the core of you, because the eating disorder is just, I suppose, a coping mechanism to feeling crap and being depressed or anxious or stressed or whatever it may be. So it was kind of really breaking down those kind of core issues that I was having and working on those, to sort of build up this sort of the strength and resilience and positive ways of dealing with those insecurities, rather than the other outlet that I'd kind of used for many, many years. Yeah. But yeah, super important.
You're now 32, as you mentioned earlier. How do you now look back on this extraordinary chapter in your life?
Yeah, it's crazy. I sometimes kind of, like, it felt like a really just shit dream.
Yeah.
Really bad dream. But, you know, and I kind of also, like, there's been times where I've sort of, you know, my parents my sister and I obviously talk about it quite a lot, especially with the release of my book recently. It's kind of brought a lot of these things to the forefront again. But it was a huge chunk of my kind of younger years. And I sort of often sort of get a little bit sad that I missed out on a lot of my childhood. Like, you know, 8 to sort of 22 really was consumed by this illness. And I don't think I really allowed myself to have fun and to be a kid and to enjoy myself. And so it's interesting because I'm now 32 and I feel like I'm doing that now. So my husband and I are massive children. As you can probably see, we've just got Lego everywhere in the back of my shop there.
And I feel like I should say right now, and you were on the Lego Masters show as well.
Yes, we're massive kids. I'm very fortunate. My husband's also like loves travel and you know, being just a big kid. And so I feel like I'm almost 32 now, reliving a lot of those years and kind of having fun. So, you know, not the last 2 years, we haven't really been able to have much fun the last 2 years, but you know, it's it was a tough time. It was a really tough time. But hey, I came out the other end.
Absolutely. You're thriving now. What would have helped you back then, do you think?
Absolutely. So this is, and again, I think this is probably the catalyst for me writing this book, Liz. I think, you know, going back to that eight sort of nine age group when it all kind of kicked off, like I kind of think, had we known a little bit more about what eating disorders are, what negative self-esteem and body image was at the time, could have that potentially sort of started a conversation between myself and my parents or potentially a teacher at school, because also teachers were noticing changes in me and behavioural changes. And so I think having a bit of a understanding of what it was would have definitely helped. But also I think the space to have the conversation and be like, okay, to talk about, actually, I'm really not coping very well right now. And so writing this book has been, obviously quite a therapeutic thing for me to do, but it's also, I'm hoping, can be used as a bit of a tool for parents and families, not just to potentially start that conversation if they're noticing someone is struggling, food is becoming an issue, that they can actually talk about it and just let someone know, because just even letting one person know will start that kind of road to sort of getting the help that you need.
Tell us about the book. What's it called and what's it all about and why was it so important to write it?
Yeah, so it's called When Anna Came to Stay. And interestingly, when I was in recovery, I a really kind of helpful tool that helped me separate myself from the illness, because I, as I was mentioning before, for a very long time, I identified as the illness. I thought anorexia was me and was how I kind of operated. But through therapy, I was able to sort of separate Maddie from these toxic eating disorder thinking. So I called the illness anorexia. So this book, When Anna Came to Stay, is my story, basically told in a very kind of from a child's perspective. So it's written in a very Dr. Seuss kind of way. It's rhyming kind of couplets and very beautiful watercolor imagery. But it's about a young girl, May, who has her world thrown upside down and has to move schools and is really overwhelmed. And a new friend comes to stay. Her name's Anna, and she's beautiful and confident, but also incredibly bossy and kind of tells May how she needs to live her life and what she can and can't do, and it'll make her feel better. And so Anna is obviously a metaphor for the eating disorder. It could be seen as anxiety as well, depression. This imaginary character of Anna takes over her life and really kind of forces May into a really, really dark place. And it's not until she gets the help of her friends and family around her that she's able to tell her to go away. I don't need you here anymore. So it's sort of it's written in a really kind of gentle way. It's more just the concepts of an unwanted thought process coming into play. And so very much sort of aimed at the sort of, I would say, 6 to 12 demographic, maybe even probably 6 to 10, a little bit younger. But for me it was very much if a kid can read this book and go, oh hey, I can relate to that May character. I have these thoughts and these yucky things that tell me I can and can't as well. That you know, maybe it can help a kid out there that's kind of potentially heading down that path.
Why was it important to target that 6 to 10 to 12 age group, that especially that 6-7 year age group?
Yeah, it's crazy because you kind of go, that's so young to be talking about such a heavy topic. And I have been asked this quite a lot. The reality is a lot of children are being diagnosed with eating disorders, and even more so in the last 2 years since the pandemic hit, a lot of kids have been really struggling with body image and food. And so absolutely for me, it was the statistics show that this is an age category that needs to be kind of addressed. I know that the Butterfly Foundation have just recently launched a fantastic new program called Body Bright that really tackles a lot of those issues in the prep to sort of age 6 category. And so, yeah, this tool I'm hoping will be able to sort of nip a few of those, you know, potential eating disorders in the bud. So it's, my husband and I worked at the Starlight Children's Foundation. That's how we met. And I found it really quite confronting at, you know, that 25, 26 year, you know, age that, you know, kids as young as 4, 5, 6 were being admitted into hospitals with eating disorders. And I kind of go, how do you even know what a diet is or what, you know, is at that age? But it's sadly the reality of the world we're living in at the moment. So yeah, that's one of the reasons I wrote it for that.
And why do you think it's so, like, you know, this ties into writing the book and speaking with me right now? And I know you've done other interviews about this and speaking so candidly and honestly about a really difficult chapter in your life. Why is it so important to be sharing how you are?
Absolutely. I think for me, you know, like I said, going back to the treatment that I had and the support that I have, having psychologists was incredibly helpful. But I think one of the things that really helped me was when I got kind of in contact with sufferers themselves, people that have come out the other end and survivors of eating disorders. And so through the Butterfly Foundation was able to kind of connect with people with lived experiences. And so I think for me, sharing my lived experience with others sort of going down that road is, it's really helpful for those suffering to hear, oh, actually she gets it. She really gets it. And she's come out the other end. And this is what worked for her. Maybe that'll work for me. So yeah, I think, you know, sharing my story, it's just sort of, I think hopefully try and kind of, pass on any sort of things that I've learned. I've done, there's an amazing group called Body Matters and they do a lot of family therapy sessions and I've joined in on a couple of those. And also for family members too, to go, oh, you know, my daughter or my son or whatever is going through something very similarly, like, you know, have you got advice for this, this and this? And even just kind of sharing my kind of journey with stuff or my experience with certain elements of going through my recovery, you know, is hopefully helpful to others.
Oh God, I can imagine it's so helpful to people. How has what you've been through changed you and made you who you are today?
Look, I definitely think it's formed, you know, who I am today, Liz, you know, in the good and the bad ways, you know, going through quite a lot of struggle. You always come out the other end having learned something about yourself. I definitely think that it's like being able to kind of work through this has made me a much more resilient person. I'm a really open person now. I wasn't a long time ago. I kept so many things close to my chest because I didn't want to upset people. I didn't want to turn people off. I didn't want to tell people how terrible I felt because, you know, in fear of turning them away, being a burden. But now it's almost the opposite. I love talking. I love talking about my feelings and I love being there to support my friends and family as well. So I definitely think it's made me a much more empathetic person. And I suppose just kind of really kind of understanding when people are struggling. Like I really get it. And I hope that, you know, people around me could feel comfortable to come to me if that is the case. So, yeah.
What do you think are the biggest lessons all of this and speaking out now at this age has taught you?
Yeah, great question. I think the probably the biggest thing that's come out of all of this is that not being okay is okay. And I think that's actually a really interesting sentiment that we've heard a lot over the last 2 years with the pandemic. You know, I think that mental illness has always been, you know, in the last couple of years has become something we talk about more. But I do think in the last 2 years with the pandemic, a lot of people that may never have really dealt with depression or anxiety have felt it. So I think it's a very much almost quite a global feeling at the moment of going, this is a really tough time and I actually need to talk about it. So talking about fear, you're talking about your feelings and just going to, you know, talking to a friend or family, you know, anyone and just saying, I'm not good. And it's okay to be not good because we're all not good at times.
Yeah.
So for me, that's been probably the biggest takeaway, you know, obviously learning what those triggers are for me and getting help when I need it.
And if someone listening has gone through something similar to you or even just something different, just at their own turmoil, what would your advice be to them?
Yeah. Great question. I think, like I said, go and talk to someone, your best mate, your mum, your dad, your dog, whatever it is, get it off your chest first. Yeah. But I think also when it comes to sort of more eating disorder related sort of issues or concerns, I think there are so many fantastic resources out there. Unlike, you know, going back to the early 90s when I was kind of struggling, there are some fantastic kind of places you can go to almost on a 24-hour kind of 7-day-a-week kind of basis. I know the Butterfly Foundation have a hotline you can call, even as someone like a support family member that might be kind of not knowing what to say or do around someone struggling. So there are so many resources out there and free as well. So I think, if you're struggling and not knowing what to do, be it someone suffering or someone in that support role, go and seek help because there's professionals out there that can guide you and show you which way to go. So, yeah.
How much of a role does social media play? And I guess how important is it if you maybe are feeling the pressure or feeling like maybe, you know, your eating habits are changing? I guess switching off, it might sound simplistic, but switching off accounts that make you feel bad about yourself, you know, unfollowing accounts that make you feel bad about yourself and kind of... Mm-hmm. Surrounding yourself with things and people that make you feel good. Like how much power is there in doing something as simple as that, I suppose, which I know can be difficult.
Yeah, totally. It can be incredibly difficult, but you've totally hit the nail on the head, Liz, because that's actually one of Butterfly's, I suppose, strategies in sort of feeling better about yourself is social media curation.
Yeah.
It is such a huge part of our lives now and more so for the younger generation. I think things like, you know, TikTok and Instagram and Snapchat and all those fantastic apps that we do use in a very positive way a lot of the time, connecting with friends, especially in the time of lockdown and pandemics, you know, it has been an incredibly helpful tool. But on the flip side, it is also incredibly dangerous. And I kind of think, you know, in the last 2 years when the data is showing that eating disorders are on the rise, and I kind of have to wonder, is there any correlation between the amount of time we're spending online? Because we're all, our screen time and time on social media has gone through the roof. I know me
so
personally.
True. Yeah.
I looked at my screen time last week and I was like, oh, Maddie, seriously, get off, girl.
Yeah.
But it is what you're watching and what you're consuming that you have the power and control over. And I think a lot of the time we sort of get a lot of messaging and toxic kind of ideals that we don't even realize.
Yeah.
Like we're just, when we're sort of aimlessly scrolling, you know, a lot of these images are sort of implanted in our head and we don't even realize it. So for me personally, I very much curate my feed. I only follow accounts that make me feel good, exactly like you said, Liz. So I'm obsessed with film and TV, so I do follow a lot of like movie trailer kind of resources, lots of funny kind of sketch people that are, you know, making funny, hilarious content during lockdown. I follow a lot of body positivity movements as well. I think anytime I sort of look at someone's feed or account that makes me feel a bit yucky or insecure about myself, I know for me that's a trigger and I go unfollow. I just need to not have that around. You know, and one of the things that I do some I do a lot of work with the Butterfly Foundation, going into schools, teaching this kind of stuff.
You're amazing.
Sort of strategies. But it's fantastic because it is, kids are so aware and so on top of this stuff already, but we do a whole segment on photoshopping and the lies that we are fed. And so, you know, even as an adult, though, as a 32-year-old, like, I kind of forget that at times, and I kind of look at these pictures and go, oh, God, like, is this what reality is? But it's not. Like, 99.99% of the stuff we're seeing is fabricated or edited or curated in a way for our eyes and mainly because people want to buy, you know, they want you to buy their products is what it is at the end of the day. Super important. This is as hard as it is. I think the old Facebook or Instagram or cleanse every now and then is really useful.
Yeah.
And also just time off the phone if we can. I know it's hard at the moment because we are living in a pandemic and there's not much else to do. But even just switching off social media for a couple of days and just having a break and just kind of removing yourself from that world can be really, really helpful.
Totally. And Maddie, what does life look like for you these days? And pandemic aside, how does life look? What are you up to?
Yeah, well, that's right. Away from earthquakes, Liz, and lockdowns. No, look, my life is really, I'm really happy. I've got, you know, I'm still very fortunate to, we both are working. But, you know, I'm pursuing my dreams as well. Like, I'm an actor and that's kind of always been my passion and drive. And so I've been, even though we're in lockdown, I've been working on writing and kind of, you know, pre-production for a few kind of films that I'm looking at making. So, yeah, it's, life's good. Life is great. I can't complain at all. I'd love to say we're going on a big holiday soon.
Yes.
But, you know, that will happen eventually. We love travel. Like I said, my sister lives in Vancouver, so I'd love to get back over there and visit her. You know, my zest for life is, you know, through the roof comparatively. And I think I'm just kind of really, you know, thriving at the moment and you know, got a lot of fun stuff to look forward to. So.
Absolutely. Oh, that's so beautiful to hear. And Maddie, I finish all my interviews in the same way with the same question. Yeah. And that is, what would advice would the Maddie now tell the Maddie in her darkest, most difficult moments?
Oh, I love that. Yeah. I think, what would I tell young Maddie? I would say, you are perfect just as you are. And I think that's something that I need to remind myself constantly, you know, and I think something we all need to remind ourselves of, you know, we're all put on this planet to be who we are. Like, not, it would be so boring if we were all looked and acted exactly the same, and that we've been given this amazing opportunity to live our life and, you know, embrace it. We're perfect just as we are. So yeah, I think that's something that I kind of have to, you know, even now remind myself of.
Yeah, that's beautiful advice, Maddie. It was such a joy and a pleasure speaking to you.
Thank you, Liz.
I was engaged with every word you were saying. You're just so phenomenal.
You're so gorgeous. Thank you, lovely. I so appreciate the chat. It's been so lovely.
Oh, gosh, it was so beautiful and it was so enlightening. And I think a lot of people, you know, maybe not all of us have had, but you know, ever been diagnosed with eating disorders or anything, but I think every woman can just identify with that pressure.
100%.
And maybe 100%. Just a day you don't eat as, you know, you might reduce meals just because you think you look fat and all that kind of stuff. Mm. You know, I think that is sadly just almost sadly part of being female sometimes. So
absolutely.
Gosh. Absolutely. And I didn't like using that fat word, but you know, that word we tell ourselves. So I think hearing someone like you string that all together and talk so candidly, I think would help, you know, people that haven't even suffered from it, but anyone that is female.
I so appreciate that, Liz. Thank you so much. It's definitely something we need to, you know, keep the dialogue going. Mm. And, you know, hopefully, you know, this will become something that we can just, anyone and everyone can talk about. And like you said, you know, it's affecting a lot of people, particularly at the moment. And, you know, there is support out there. So, you know, you're not alone.
Totally. And I'll put all those links to all support networks in the show notes, as well as to your beautiful book. Thank you again, Maddie.
Oh, thank you, Liz. It's been an absolute pleasure. I so appreciate the time. And yeah, I hope you have a beautiful weekend.
You too. Thanks, darling.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Lemonade. If this chat brought up any discomfort, 24-hour help is available through the Butterfly Foundation on 1-800-334-673 or Lifeline on 13 11 14. I'll pop a link to where you can purchase a copy of Maddie's children's book in the show notes. I'll also pop a link to her Instagram handle as well as mine, at Elizabeth Neal. You can also follow Lemonade at Lemonade the Podcast. If you enjoyed this chat, please share it on your social media and tag us. Otherwise, you can show Lemonade some love by hitting subscribe, leaving a positive review, hitting 5 stars. All of it really helps. I'll be back tomorrow, actually, with an episode of A Lemon a Day. Chat then.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.